Welcome to Impact Point. I'm Marcia Slocum, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nilima Grover, founder and CEO of Q2 Impact, where we bring together the voices shaping how the U.S. government meets the challenges of a rapidly changing world. For nearly three decades, Q2 Impact has been at the intersection of human-centered design and government problem-solving, not just studying what's broken, but building tools and systems that fix it. We believe the most durable solutions start with understanding how people think, how they work, how they decide, and how they operate under pressure. Today's guest embodies that exact tension. Ben Rohrbaugh has spent his career on both sides of the hardest problems in national security. He served as the Director for Enforcement and Border Security at the National Security Council, as a senior advisor at the Department of Homeland Security, and he's the author of More or Less Afraid of Nearly Everything, a clear-eyed look at how America confronts risk. Now, as co-founder of Lantern UAS, he's building technology designed to do something the government has struggled to do on its own: use artificial intelligence to fuse counter-UAS sensor data and provide decision support that eases the cognitive burden on operators. That journey from policy to entrepreneur gives Ben a rare vantage point on three questions we hear constantly in our work. Why does government technology move so slowly when the threats don't? Why can't the systems talk to each other? And how do we actually fix acquisition before the window closes? Ben, welcome to Impact Point.
Thank you so much, Marcia. It's a real pleasure to be here.
We're glad to have you today. I'm just going to jump into my first question. You know, interoperability is one of those words that gets used constantly in government circles, but rarely gets solved. When agencies are operating with systems that can't talk to each other, it's ultimately the operator in the field who pays the price. Where does this break down most visibly, and what are the real impediments to fixing it?
Sure. So in the counter-UAS spot, the counter-UAS space, the interoperability challenges kind of break down everywhere. This is a comprehensive problem and one that we're really just starting to adapt to, particularly domestically. So first, we just generally don't have sufficient air domain awareness under 400 feet. It's a challenge, and especially when we're talking about very small drones, just to identify what's out there, to figure out what's potentially threatening, what's compliant, what's not, and then to start to evaluate what kind of response is appropriate. And so counter UAS operators and folks who either are working in the federal government, state, local, tribal law enforcement, or in critical infrastructure contexts are starting to try and fill in those gaps and starting to put in place different systems. And there certainly are specialist systems using things like radio frequency identification that provide some level of domain awareness, but it really needs to be combined with the different levels of sensors that are available both now from other systems and with sensors that can provide a broader and earlier warning about things. So you know, we may have, as an example, a base or some kind of installation may have a radio frequency-based detection system that can provide awareness about compliant drones that are transmitting their identification and location, but that will almost never be connected to different camera feeds that they have, which could provide more information about a potential threat and provide details about whether it's carrying a payload or other things that need to be figured out. There also will be, in some situations, thermal sensors that need to be exploited, where you need information from those to be taken and brought in to operators to provide information about potential threats. And then that needs to be combined with things like acoustic sensors, which can provide earlier warning and are less expensive and can be deployed broadly to provide an additional level of air domain awareness. And so all this stuff is out there, and there's technology that can help operators figure out when threats are coming. But right now, it tends to be siloed. And so in places like emergency operations centers, where they need to take this information, fuse it together, and figure out what's actually presenting, right now, that's very much a live problem. And people are working to set data standards. They're working to provide control systems that take this information and fuse it together. But it's not generally presented in a way that makes sense for operators. And so that's just a the domain awareness challenge on interoperability. From there, we get into these different response systems where, you know, a base, some kind of installation may have multiple different systems that can mitigate a potential threat using electronic warfare tools, you know, maybe cyber takeover, things like that. But those generally all have their own command and control systems, and they sort of raced forward on the response capability, but haven't necessarily focused on integrating with other things. And so you'll hear stories about bases where there's, you know, seven different systems on seven different screens, which is the kind of thing that people in emergency operations centers hate, right? They don't want to have to jump from screen to screen as they're figuring this out. There are other layers then when you start to get into the response communication where you've seen a threat. So if I'm an operator domestically and I work at a base and I see a potentially threatening swarm of drones moving past us, and it may be going towards an airport, and I want to communicate that threat to the operators at the airport. How do I do that? How can I provide any of the detail I'm seeing? Right now, when, you know, I've participated in things like tabletop exercises and we talk to operators, it's a lot of like, we're going to get on the phone or get on the radio and we're going to talk to each other about this. We're going to tell them what we're seeing. We're going to have to describe it. Inevitably, it's described as like, we have great communication. We talk all the time. But when you start to drill down into how information would be passed along, there are almost always giant gaps in how this is done. So it is really, the interoperability challenge is enormous across this space and really just beginning to be addressed by some of the tools that are coming out.
Well, let me jump in here, Ben. Thank you for that comprehensive response. So you run a company called Lantern right now. How are you working in this space? Can you tell us a little bit more about what you are doing and how are you seeing this problem play out in the work that you're doing right now?
Sure. So we are focused on counter UAS tools that are designed to ease the cognitive burden on operators. And so we're working with the autonomy capability team at the Air Force Research Laboratory, try and build tools where we're using agentic AI to take information from multiple sensor streams, interpret it, and then provide it to operators in a way where it's less overwhelming than it can otherwise be, where they're getting natural language information about threats, and they're able to get recommendations on potential decisions that are grounded in information about their regulatory constraints and other environmental factors. This gets incredibly complicated very quickly, right? When you're taking lots of different sensor information and trying to fuse it and then connect that to things like flight restrictions, which are constantly changing, other kinds of response constraints, information about potentially vulnerable areas or other things. And then when you start to talk about moving mitigation systems, right, where you've got something maybe you've tested on a military facility and there's a threat across town, so you want to move it. And now you have to figure out, you know, the impact of like a GPS jammer that was fine in one place, but now is closer to a commercial airport or something. And so that's our focus, is trying to take all of those different pieces and develop tools that can actually interpret that and ease the burden on operators while not overstepping in terms of what can be automated and what can't. You know, we still need a human in the loop for a lot of these decisions. And so trying to support that process without overdoing it is an interesting and complex challenge.
That's a huge challenge, right? So you're in an experimentation mode, or do you have any tools and solutions developed right now?
We're going through what they call the small business innovation research process. And so we've gone through the prototyping phase and are working now to build something that can actually be tested in the field. It's very much an iterative process as we go through and talk with lots of different operators at different levels of government to try and figure out, you know, okay, maybe we've got a tool that could make sense in a base context where there's very expansive authorities, but how does that work for a operator at a power plant where they're much more constrained in terms of what they can do in response to a potential threat? And how do we make sure that we're still being, you know, we're providing tools that are effective in a dual use context?
I recently listened to a podcast from DHS. They have an official podcast, and Steve Willoughby, who sits on the Science and Technology Directorate, was talking about the pace of technology and how it takes 6 months to test a tool. And by the time the federal government has tested tools, the technology has moved on. How are you addressing that with your testing and getting your product to market in time so that the government can use it? Like, have they started using it? Is that a challenge for you guys?
Yeah, it's a huge challenge. I mean, the government processes are slow. I mean, even the sort of accelerated research processes, you know, you'll have situations where they'll say, okay, deliver this over a 2-year time frame, and you're writing a plan now and you're going to deliver something at the end of it based on this work plan. And, you know, I think we've all seen in the counter UAS space that something, you know, the challenges that we would have identified 2 years ago are obsolete. You know, we weren't talking about fiber optic drones 2 years ago, right? And so things are advancing so quickly that it doesn't make sense to just say, well, all right, we'll go through these processes and at the end of it, we'll have something that's useful. I think for us, part of what we are trying to do is structure our work in a way where as new information, as new responses and new kinds of tactics come out, where our system won't be immediately obsolete, where we're able to take in different kinds of information like that and incorporate it and put sort of useful responses in front of operators. And so we very intentionally stayed away from tying ourselves to a specific hardware system because we're seeing all of these, you know, crazy kind of like science experiments in the battlefield and the different kinds of responses that are coming out. And so we've taken certain steps to try and make sure that what we're doing is responsive and adapt to that. But yeah, it's a huge challenge. And even the accelerated kind of challenge-paced government opportunities to engage, you know, often are just on timeframes that don't work, you know, 3, 4 months, 6 months to review a proposal. I mean, that kind of stuff, it's overtaken by events by the time they actually make a decision about it.
Do you think that given the magnitude of the issue and the way things are changing so quickly, the government realizes that they have to really change the pace at which they need to absorb and innovate and take in new innovations? Is that realization there within the government right now? Are you seeing that?
I'm seeing it on certain levels. I think they are, I think officials are recognizing it, but the response has largely been, well, we'll acquire finished systems faster. So if you have something now that you can take out in a field and basically make a drone fall out of the sky, people want to see that now and they may buy it, right? There are opportunities right now to move that kind of stuff quickly. If you are at a different level of technological development, though, and you're saying, hey, we're at this point and we can get here, but we need to engage with operators in the government. Like, we need feedback. We need some level of partnership, or maybe we need this access to certain information in order to take this tool where we need to get to. That's much more challenging right now. And there you're sort of back in these research pathways, which, as we've talked about, can tend to be slow and deliberative. So it really, you know, it's something that I think there's a recognition of, but that doesn't mean that, you know, suddenly all of these processes are faster than the way they've been designed.
It's almost like the federal government needs to revise how it's even looking at procurement, how it's looking at partnerships with the private sector so that they can engage with organizations like Lantern UAS and continuously produce solutions without having to go through the procurement system to kind of get them those solutions in real time.
Yeah, we have been fortunate. We've had some good partners that we've been able to work with in government as we've been developing this, you know, and I want to recognize that, but that's taken a lot of work from us and it's been a start and stop process. When we did the beginning of our small business innovation research contract to start working with folks, the thing that initially opened up some of this for us, and we applied for an opportunity in like November 2024. We were selected for it in April 2025, and we were funded in September 2025. You know, like that kind of stuff. I mean, which is standard. You know, that can be really challenging when you're a small business and you're excited about something and you want to move it forward. So I would say that having ways where people can engage at different parts of the process is really important. And I would say it's much more robust on the military side than it is with other federal agencies. I think it's much more challenging if you want to go and interact with Department of Homeland Security or Department of Justice agencies as a small business that's developing innovative technology, like there generally just aren't the same kind of mechanisms and access points that you might have on the military side.
Well, a couple of things come to mind. You know, one is it used to be that the federal government was a leader in innovation, and that paradigm has switched now. It's really commercial firms that are leading the charge here. And I think there is a realization for commercial dual use, but the practical approaches to really incorporating that have not really evolved yet. Where I am also seeing a real gap, and I'd love to get your perspective on this, Ben, is there's a lot of money being spent on equipment. And my own concern is that the equipment that you buy today is going to become obsolete tomorrow, because the technology is changing, especially in the UAS space, very quickly. And ultimately, it's people that have to use this technology. And there isn't enough that's happening to really train our people to ensure that they are prepared for anything bad that could happen in the UAS space, because the threat is not only in the war field, but it's really everywhere now. So I don't see enough discussion on the human side of it and the preparation side of it, and a lot more investment going in the equipment side of it. Do you see it that way?
Oh, yeah, I think that's absolutely right. You know, there is a huge focus on new counter UAS tools right now, I think at multiple levels of government. There's a lot more funding. I think each of the last several years, Congress has appropriated more funds for counter UAS than was requested, right? I mean, that's an unusual state of affairs. And so there is a ton of interest in new tools. But what generally has happened so far is that's gone into hardware. It's gone into basically solutions where you can go out in a field, you can test it, and you can show that a drone falls down or blows up or something that says, all right, we're going to take this threat and neutralize it. I would compare this to the earlier days of, I'm going to date myself a little bit here, but like the cybersecurity threat, where I remember working in the Department of Homeland Security in 2009, and people were talking about cyber, but it was really like specialized. It's like, well, that's something that this group of like 20 somethings works in a secure room somewhere. And that was it. At the time, the Secretary of Homeland Security didn't send emails, right? It was just very, very isolated. And I think right now, a lot of the attempts at finding solutions are like a lot of the solutions people were looking for in the cyber side back then. It's like, well, we'll just buy like an antivirus system and then I won't have a cyber problem anymore, right? Like I have this security gap, I'll buy this system and great, I'll be done and I can go off and continue doing whatever it was I was doing. And what this challenge really is much more like, it's a systems and a training and a processes challenge where organizations are really going to have to think through at multiple levels, how are we getting like intelligence about emerging threats? Like, what do we need to be most concerned about? What is changing? What are dangerous actors doing? How are new techniques, you know, sort of shifting around the world? It's like, if we're seeing certain things happening in the Middle East, like Hezbollah is doing some certain specific tactic, and suddenly we start seeing that in the Western Hemisphere somewhere, you know, how does that information get past critical infrastructure, border security operators, and how do they start incorporating that in what they're doing? How do organizations think through not just, you know, which hardware we need to procure, which they need to think through, but also how is that integrated in our existing system? How are we going to take that and connect it to these larger processes? Also, a lot of hardware, a lot of the mitigation systems that are out there will fit very well for like a certain scenario. It's something where it affects like these different jamming systems or cyber takeover, things like that. Those work very well for certain models of drones where they're transmitting. But there's a whole range of other situations, from very scary situations where a drone maybe have fiber optic cable that's controlling it, where you're not going to be able to intercept the communications, to nuisance scenarios where it's just a hobbyist or something who's flown outside of appropriate areas, where you're going to want to have local police go tell them to knock it off, maybe scare them a little bit. You're not necessarily going to want in all of these situations to use the same tool. And so the responses that people are thinking about, that operators and organizations are thinking about, need to incorporate all of that. Instead of just saying, am I going to press the button to send this interceptor or to use this effector, they need to be going through the entire process, thinking about who they're going to coordinate with. How does, you know, our emergency operations center connect with other ones in the area? Are there steps we need to take with our infrastructure? Do we need to put up netting in certain very sensitive areas? Do we need to think through how we would respond to aerial surveillance, how that would change some of our operation? Do we need to think through what happens when there's just a safety concern from a drone in an area that's sensitive, and how we alter our operations and communicate internally about that? How do we communicate to a workforce that we've seen something? Yes, we see it. You can all stop calling and telling us that there's a drone in this area. It shouldn't be like that kind of stuff. All of these problems, I think organizations are going to need the kind of support that exists now in the cyber world and doesn't exist in the counter UAS space, right? Where they can get training, they can get threat intelligence, they can get red teaming, tabletop exercise, gap analysis kind of processes, and they can get support as they implement these things across their systems, where it's not just, do we buy a tool or not? It's a comprehensive organizational response to an evolving and flexible threat.
I want to kind of make two distinctions here. One, you know, I'm hearing you talk about systems thinking, and that's something that Q2 Impact has done throughout our history, right? Like, we have always thought about how human beings are using information to make decisions and how that impacts their environment around them and second and third order effects. And really, what I'm hearing is that we need a human-centered design approach to this. And we need to keep the human in the loop. And then the other distinction that I want to make is something that we brought up in our very first podcast about AI and human beings. And it's called cognitive offloading. It's where human beings are giving all of their decision-making power to the AI. And it almost sounds as though when the US government is purchasing hardware and tools to impact drones in their immediate environment, they're not really considering the long-term implications of, you still need to train your staff. You still need interagency coordination. You still need that human in the loop. And for anybody listening to this podcast, I would highly encourage them to take that approach, right? Because that's one of the things that I hear discussed in this industry a lot, is that the federal government is, and you just said it, it's procuring a lot of hardware, a lot of tools, but the training of personnel to use those tools effectively and when to use them, but also when to engage with their counterparts, because they do need to communicate what's happening. So I haven't quite seen the federal government get there in its procurement. And I wanted to know your thoughts about that.
Yeah, I think it's a great point. Companies have tended to follow where, you know, the dollars are for acquisitions, and that has been on capabilities to neutralize a drone. And so they've sort of raced ahead on that. But this piece of what that actually looks like to the person, the human who has to operate it in whatever kind of base defense operations center, emergency operations center they're going to be in, has generally been a secondary concern. And so when we work with folks doing new technology in the military, they'll give us feedback where they say, like, if you give us a standalone screen, like, we're going to throw it out the window. We do not want something that isn't integrated with the other command and control systems we have. Or if you start generating like tons of drop-down alerts, right? You know, it's like, okay, there's an alert and operators have to like click through drop-down after drop-down as multiple drones are appearing. Like, they're going to just shut down. They're going to hate this system. And, you know, we're going to get feedback because that's what they're getting in lots of situations. And that piece of it hasn't been addressed in as comprehensive a way where people, you know, just think about what the operator's workflow is, right? If we're going to have a bunch of potential alerts and then out of that, a certain small number are going to be real threats, what does that actually look like to the human who has to interpret that and make an intelligent response and a really high stakes response? And how is the information coming out actually supporting that? Related to your second point, there are places in this where some level of autonomy and automated systems are essential, because you really don't want to have an operator simultaneously monitoring multiple camera feeds and trying to figure out, wait, is, oh, no, that's a bird or that kind of thing, right? You really need to narrow down what's being identified as potentially threatening. And there are lots of places across this response spectrum where things really can be automated, where you can take steps where maybe the operator's aware of something, but they don't necessarily need to approve everything, like internal communication protocols. Like, we're going to make sure that different parts of the organization are alerted about something, that they're being told that we're starting a certain response protocol, stuff like that. Even things like, well, we're connecting, we're opening up secure chats with different organizations, or maybe even we're sharing a map view of a potential threat we're monitoring with other organizations that are partners. Some of that stuff could be automated, and that's okay. Now, a actual mitigation response, like we're going to send up a kinetic interceptor or something like that, you're always going to want a human to make those kind of decisions. But I think there are opportunities through like pre-approved protocols and standard operating procedures and other stuff like that, where you can start to think about, hey, like what can we shift to automate more and take it away from this burden on the operator? But then where do we really need a person involved, focused, looking at evidence and confirming, here's why I'm making this decision and why I believe that's authorized?
I think you really hit on a very important point, both you and Marcia. And this is the point that keeps me awake at night, because ultimately it is people who are sitting with the information that have to make decisions. And there is all this stuff that gets thrown at people in terms of, you know, decisions, that information. And there is no common operating picture here. And it's changing every day. And so I really believe that we have to do some fundamental rethinking on the preparedness piece, because that is such an important piece. And I think we are too much focused on the equipment piece and not enough on the preparedness piece. And that really is scary to me. I feel like we are missing the picture here. Or maybe there are people who are thinking about this. I surely hope so. But not enough is being done to really ensure that we are preparing adequately for this, because I feel that that's such a big gap and there's so much work that needs to be done there. What are your perspectives on that? Am I scared about the wrong things here, or is the problem really huge and we are not looking at the right things or the full picture? We're not paying enough attention to this. Do you agree with me, or do you have a different perspective?
No, I share your perspective. I'd say there's two pieces to it. The first is that while there is a huge focus on these sort of extreme threat scenarios, you know, this what the military would call exquisite capabilities to respond to these, you know, there's a drone with a bomb on it coming, right? We need something that will go up and intercept this and destroy it. And that's where a lot of the procurement's focus has been. Still domestically, almost no organizations are prepared for that. You know, if you sit down and run a tabletop exercise with folks who are involved in major urban areas and go through, well, how would you respond to a real attack scenario? Almost inevitably, you're going to start to get people sort of shrugging. What I've at least seen is that they tend to assume that there's another level of government, you know, that will address it. It's like, well, that's when we'd call the FBI. And then like, if there's someone from the FBI in the corner, she raises her hand and says like, well, hold on, you know, like we're like, what mitigation equipment? Like, are we going to fly it in from the National Capital Region? And then the other thing is people aren't constantly saying, well, and that's when we call the local, you know, whatever the nearest military base is. And as someone who has worked with some of these bases, like, you know, I think they would also be raising their hands thing. Like, well, wait a minute. Like, what are you assuming we have, and how are you assuming we're going to do it? The other thing is that Marcia and I were talking about this at that conference. There's this generally like assumed but unspoken belief among law enforcement and others that like, look, if a drone threat gets bad enough, they'll just open up and shoot it down. The officers will go out and they'll like take care of business and they'll shoot down these drones. And that is an assumption that really needs to be unpacked a little bit, because if there is an attack in a major city or something, and there's still a bunch of other hobbyist drones in the air, or there are responder drones that are suddenly coming out and every officer around is suddenly like pulling the shotgun out of their vehicle and trying to hit these things, like you're looking at really chaotic, really dangerous scenarios. And also where, I mean, if the plan is going to be that people are going to start shooting drones down, like you really need to think about what munitions you're using, because it's very challenging in a way that I think people who aren't engaged with it don't don't always appreciate. So yeah, that's like, I think there are really preparedness gaps there. But then on the other side, it's not just these drone with a bomb on sort of battlefield kind of scenarios that we're seeing in Ukraine or Lebanon. There are a lot of ways that drones can be extremely, extremely disruptive that are also not always planned for and appreciated. So, you know, we've seen in Europe and in Denmark and Ireland how their state-sponsored drones can disrupt commercial aviation just by flying over airports in really extreme ways, where you're going to have to shut down flights, try and figure out what kind of response is appropriate, how you track these, things that could be extremely expensive and disruptive. They're also, drones cause major safety issues at power plants, refinery kind of settings, where you wouldn't let staff bring lithium batteries, right? You wouldn't have their phones in certain settings. And suddenly, if a drone's flying overhead, it just creates major disruption. You need to shut down operations. You need to figure out what kind of response is appropriate. All of that. And then, you know, there's the surveillance piece, which, of course, like if people are obviously surveilling law enforcement officers, it happens a ton at the border. That's something you want to be able to respond to and figure out why it's happening and prevent. And then contraband, right? This is a, you know, in prisons and border context where you have drones that are either carrying and are desperate for something or trying to drop things. It's a whole suite of challenges. And I think sometimes these other pieces of it get obscured because we're so sort of transfixed by the stuff we're seeing in the news from battlefield context. But these other threats in some cases are much more likely to be experienced and certainly not appropriately planned, trained, or prepared for in terms of the equipment that's available.
I really wish you had given me a different answer, Ben.
So, Nalima, not to scare you even more, and, you know, maybe we keep this whole engagement.
I'm already very scared after what Ben told me.
I'm going to do it anyway, Nalima. I'm going to say it anyway. We're watching all these threats unfold. We have imaginations beyond belief about what could happen. But what is the drone threat that we're not seeing? What are we not thinking about? What's a vulnerability that we are not considering, that's not getting enough attention, and how do we get ahead of it?
So, I mean, we've talked about a lot of giant vulnerabilities, right? And I think those are very clear. I would say in terms of things that are upcoming that we haven't really seen yet, one of the vulnerabilities that I think we've just begun thinking about is like drone threats to things that are in transit. You know, we're removing sensitive equipment around the country, or we've got convoys or other things like that, or we've got any kind of like sensitive material being showing nuclear material, other things. Like, how do we think through an appropriate response to threats to those? It is just nascent, especially as we're talking about moving through different kinds of airspace and other things. Like, that's new. I think threats to like really high profile individuals, whether it's like ultra net worth individuals or other folks who don't have like the same protection that the Secret Service provides and the authorities around that, we haven't really figured out what that looks like. And there are folks who may have like really sort of serious security privacy concerns, but who the family offices, other things, don't have any ability legally to respond in a serious way to drone threats. I think all of that is sort of pending and hasn't come out. But at least to me, this is kind of punting on the question, but that the most concerning threats are the ones that will present in the coming years that we're just not thinking about yet, because this is evolving so quickly. We talk about how the way drone technology has shifted in the battlefield is really comparable over the last, at this point, 4 years, is really comparable only to the way aviation developed in the First World War, where at the beginning, like, pilots are like waving to each other and then eventually taking pot shots with pistols. And then by the end of it, you've got like medical evacuation planes, you get specialized bombers, you've got air to ground communication, right? You have all of these really specialized functions, this ecosystem that just evolved. These entities within the ecosystem evolved incredibly quickly. And it suddenly, the threats that were presenting on the battlefield are totally different than what people had thought about several years ago. And so we've seen it with fiber optic controls and drones. We're not really sure what's going to come next and how that's going to present, but we're having trouble adapting to what's out there now. So it's going to be an enormous challenge, however it evolves.
You know, that you say that because you'd mentioned the conference that you and I were at recently, the ISOA America's conference in Miami. And one of the biggest threats in the Western Hemisphere is PRC influence, right? And the reason why PRC was able to entrench itself so deeply into that region is because the United States was hyper-focused on Afghanistan and Iraq, you know? And so I wonder if there needs to be some kind of mind shift where, yes, of course, we're focusing on the drone threat. We focus on the cybersecurity threat, but how does the US government or how does the private sector become more agile, not to predict the threats, but to not let the threats get so bad and to not constantly be looking just in one direction at a time?
So in terms of the counter UAS, I mean, part of that has been driven by the government acting so slowly to create a regulatory regime that actually enables people to respond. When I talk with critical infrastructure operators, some of them will say things like, why would I buy a new detection system? I can't do anything when I detect a drone. Like I'm calling the police anyway, right? Like I don't have There aren't flight restrictions that I've been able to put in place. I'm not able to use mitigation equipment. Like, what am I supposed to do? And as the government releases, as new regulations are coming out that will enable some kind of response, you know, those have been 10 years in the making. I mean, there have been some real slowness to act to create a regulatory regime that even begins to address some of this. So I think that's part of it. But you know, the other thing is that adapting to new threatening sort of defense technologies is hard. I mean, it really is something where unless you're engaged with what's happening and unless you're really flexible, it's very hard to do. And a lot of these long-term procurement planning cycles and operations aren't very well suited for that. If you were doing a multi-year investment plan or something as a company or as the government in 2020, 2021, you would have been blindsided by the way in which, you know, we were blindsided by the way drone technology advanced in 2022, 2023, 2024, and onward. And so I think the maintaining the flexibility and trying to be sure to have mechanisms to incorporate new technology, new approaches is paramount. And it's not something that we've been all that successful always in the past.
I'm listening to both of you, and I agree with everything that you guys are saying. But I feel that one of the biggest vulnerabilities that we have right now is that we need to be thinking about drone threats ubiquitously. They're everywhere today. They're not just in certain parts of the world, they're not certain parts of the country, they are everywhere. And so when you think about what, you know, when you talk about what's the threat that we're not seeing, I think it's going to be something that's going to happen in your backyard that you're not thinking about because we're not geared towards thinking in that way right now. I have a couple of friends who have told me recently, one went to see a FIFA match and found drones flying around and said it was very disconcerting. Maybe there were surveillance drones. There was another friend who went to see the UFC fight at the White House and saw drones. And it makes people nervous. This is just a new thing that we are not used to right now. And the fact is, a drone attack can happen anywhere, anytime. Just like we didn't know 911 was going to happen, I feel that our biggest vulnerability is the things that can happen in our everyday life that we're not thinking about. And the technology is evolving so quickly that we don't know what we don't know, and something bad can happen. And the best thing that we can do is be prepared for it. And that's why I think that really focusing on the preparedness piece is really critical right now. And building on what you just said, Ben, maybe it's like building it in every aspect of everything. We should be thinking about drones at every aspect of security, every aspect of life. So it's something very systemic that needs to happen. This threat is not just restricted to certain things. I think it's everywhere.
I generally agree. I mean, the examples you mentioned of World Cup games and the White House, those are the only places right now where we really have mitigation capabilities in place, right? Where actually the federal government, federal law enforcement really have expansive authorities and have tools out there. But there are an enormous amount of other sensitive sites where there's nothing in place. I mean, so right now the FAA has the Part 2209 rules open for comment, but that will be the process through which they'll be able critical infrastructure will we expect, be able to apply for flight restrictions. And people are talking about thousands, maybe 10,000 different entities potentially applying for flight restrictions. And so there's an enormous number of different entities that are already seeing drones in ways that are concerning and trying to adapt to it. To your second point, security operations right now are pretty evolved in the way we think about access control to sites and the way we think about monitoring any kind of installation or facility, right? Where you've got some kind of security center, you've got multiple cameras, you have access control, you're identifying whether someone is allowed to be inside the building, the area, et cetera, and then monitoring all of the different places where someone potentially intrude. And the UAS capabilities have suddenly created a whole new vector of that, where now you have to figure out which of these drones are compliant, which ones are not, which ones are potentially threatening in terms of surveillance, and which ones are not, and then which ones are the really scary scenarios, where it's something that's not transmitting, or it's something that has a fiber optic cable controlling it, or something like that. How do I identify that quickly and respond? And all of that is very much to be determined right now. A lot of the different approaches will have piecemeal parts of it, but it's this sort of additional level that security operators are going to have to think about in all kinds of critical infrastructure and public safety contexts that they're just beginning to figure out now, and training and gap analysis and processes where they can figure that out and understand what they need to adapt to will be essential.
I want to pick up on something you said. I don't know enough about it, so I'm curious. You said we were prepared for UFC and FIFA. Are we?
Well, what I mean is that those are places where the National Capital Region right now, and especially in advance of the America 250 events, and then the World Cup games, I think 11 sites in the United States, are ones where there are federal agencies that have been given expansive response authorities and where they have brought tools to the sites, different mitigation tools to the sites. So like the Department of Homeland, I think at the World Cup games, it's the Department of Homeland Security, and then a few of them are done by the FBI, but where they've brought the mitigation equipment they have to those sites and where they have expansive authorities to be able to respond. And certainly at the White House led by the Secret Service, they can shoot things down that are potentially threatening and others. That doesn't necessarily exist at like another large event that's occurring. So if there's some other major event, lots of people are there, something like that, I think if you ask people at the Department of Homeland Security, hey, we've got some other giant event that's happening and we may need equipment to protect us from drone threats, I think they would say, sorry, we're busy with the World Cup. We're stretched out responding to this. So yeah, we're about as prepared in those sites as we are anywhere. But then other things that are happening right now, I don't think there's the capability from federal law enforcement to respond to much more than those.
I could see that. But then my pushback would be, just because you have equipment doesn't mean you're prepared.
That's really true. Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's
right. You have the best equipment to shoot things down, but you have all these fans and you have a match happening. And do you really want to be shooting down drones in the middle of a match? And is that, do they have the right information to be making the right decisions? It comes back to my original point of fear, is that if our people aren't prepared enough and they don't know enough and they haven't been trained enough, even the best equipment in the world cannot do the job that we need them to do. So this is where I feel that there's still, even in the best of situations, vulnerabilities. And you can buy all the equipment in the world, but if your people are not coordinated and trained and they don't know how to work under stress in a situation where something unexpected happens, the best of equipment is not going to save you. And then the question becomes, there's going to be bad consequences of shooting things down. Have you considered all the options? And how do you make the least bad decision in a bad situation? That's a whole can of worms that, to me, really highlights the crux of what we've been discussing here, which is the human in the loop, the importance of training, but also the fact that this is a much bigger issue. And companies like yours that are really at the cutting edge of doing really innovative work using AI and building solutions are really important at this time.
Thank you so much. And I agree that the other side is if there is an incident and there's a response that isn't appropriate, or if, say, a drone is shot down, some kind of kinetic interception happens and it falls on people or something dangerous happens, the operators involved are going to be miserable responding to hostile information requests for a huge amount of time afterwards, right? The folks who are involved in the incidents in El Paso and I think Fort Hancock with Customs and Border Protection, where first Customs and Border Protection used a laser to shoot down something that was, I think, determined to be a balloon. And then a military laser was used against a Customs and Border Protection drone. Those folks involved in that have been just drowning in information requests from DHS, from Congress, from the White House. Everyone, if there's an incident like that, everyone wants to know, why did you make that decision? What authorities were you acting under? And you can even, you know, there could be serious legal liability in these because you're legally downing an aircraft, right? You're taking action against an aircraft. And so I think there can be this fairly casual attitude about these threats initially, but when there's an incident, it's really, really serious. And operators will have an enormous amount to explain about why they made decisions, why things happened. And I think without either the right training, but also the right systems to be able to document why you made a certain decision, what authorities you were acting under, how you were interpreting the threat at the time, like why this was an active threat, why you're able to make that determination, all that's essential. And folks are both going to need new training, tools, processes to deal with it, but new software to knit together.
Like, what's your next move? You wrote that book. And the book really talks about, you know, you're afraid of the wrong things. What are we not afraid of? What's the next wrong thing that we should be thinking about? We've talked a lot about it already, but that would be another question.
Sure. I mean, I'll try and answer that last one without making the conversation more depressing than it's already been. Yeah. So our next move, you know, we're really focused on building out new agentic AI tools combined with sort of edge detection stuff that's more deterministic to try and make operators' lives easier. And so we're excited to advance that both with the military, but also to provide tools for state and local law enforcement and critical infrastructure. And we're now able to engage with those folks more to really try and take this to the next level. So that's really exciting for us. We also do some consulting. Generally, it's been for like, you know, we describe as like ultra high net worth individuals with drone security and privacy concerns. But I think there are needs on that side too, in the consulting and training side that are becoming much more urgent, where there's some really interesting opportunities to help folks understand gaps and actually respond to them in ways where, you know, the steps they can take now, right? Thinking through response processes, protocols, communication, changes to infrastructure, stuff like that, where it's not necessarily like, all right, you need to go procure multi-million dollar systems, but here are a bunch of things we can work through that you can do right now that are helpful. So that's what we're doing, and we're really excited about it. In terms of the message for folks in government, you know, I would just encourage folks to be really try and find ways to engage with companies that aren't just these like one-off longer-term processes where they're able to have feedback, where they're able to open things up and show some level of interest outside of just traditional contracting, you know, especially when you're a smaller business and you're trying to and you're advancing technology and moving things forward. It's really important to be able to engage and get feedback from folks in government. And sometimes, you know, I think people in government sort of rightly think, well, I'm going to, you know, stay away from industry outside of people who've already had acquisitions or something, but that can close it down a lot. I think there are a lot of folks in the defense tech world who are trying to build new systems. And if they're not actually able to engage with operators on some level, they're going to build things that aren't, that don't match the needs that are in place. So I would really encourage folks, it doesn't just need to be, yeah, we're doing these contract processes, but there need to be ways to engage outside of those just to get the kind of feedback that appeals to developing technology will need to make it useful. And then last, like my book was, the title is, it's called More or Less Afraid of Nearly Everything. The title comes from a Dashiell Hammett story, where a character says something along the lines of, you know, did it ever occur to you that everyone is more or less afraid of nearly everything, and courage isn't a damn thing, but not dodging things because you're afraid of them. And I think, you know, it is important for all of us. There's a bunch of these scary things out there, but we need to address them forthrightly. And, I at least think that instead of going through a list of like other stuff that I find really scary, like nuclear weapons or bioweapons or things like that, or noting, right, nuclear technology is now like 80 years old. One of the messages I try to put forward in the book is the importance of like layered security processes that treat threats as moving through criminal corridors. And I think now I'll often see folks talking about, whether it's border security or other efforts, plans to just intercept something dangerous right when it arrives, right? We're going to have something that's coming, and then, you know, something dangerous is going to arrive, and we're going to intercept it right at our perimeter, and that's how we're going to keep ourselves safe. And I think you always need to think about threats as moving through corridors, always in multiple countries, and you need to try and attack them everywhere they go. So, you know, for example, for a counter UAS threat, we don't want to be in a situation where, you know, dangerous drones are showing up at the border. We see them as they arrive at the border, and whatever Golden Dome something system we have neutralizes them all, and that's it. Like, they just appear, and, you know, it's like we don't want to turn our security into like a game of duck hunt, you know, where stuff just like, I'm, I guess, dating myself with the Nintendo reference, but where stuff just appears and we try and stop it immediately. We need to think about like, where are these dangerous things originating? How do we work with partners and others to try and intercept them all throughout the processes where they're transiting to the United States? And how do we also deal with the parts of the criminal corridors that are in our own country and really attack them throughout? So I would just say that layered security on a corridor approach is essential as we figure out how to respond to these new generation of, you know, stateless threats.
That might actually be the content of another podcast, because that's a fascinating, that to me is a fascinating subject, because there's so much that needs to be done there as we think about the corridors through which we need to be thinking about counter UAS training. And there is so much work that needs to be done there. But thank you for that response. It certainly gives us a lot more to think about and explore as we dig into this very big issue.
This conversation has been amazing. It's just a reminder of how much is at stake and how much the gap between policy and technology, between what we buy and how we use it, between systems that should be talking to each other but aren't, all has real consequences for the people in the field and the threats that we're trying to stay ahead of. So again, at Q2 Impact, this is exactly the type of work that we show up for every day. 28 years of human-centered design applied to some of the hardest problem sets that the U.S. government faces. The through line in everything we do is the same one that has run through this conversation, which is the best technology in the world really only matters if the people using it can use it effectively, can use it timely, and can use it at different levels of discretion in the moments that really count. Ben, thank you for bringing your experience, your candor, and your builder's perspective to Impact Point. For our listeners, if today's conversation sparked something, a question, a challenge you're facing, a problem that sounds familiar, we would love to hear from you. And if you found this valuable, share it with somebody who needs to hear it. We will be posting this podcast in the coming weeks. It'll show up on Spotify. There will be a link to it on our LinkedIn page. You can listen to it on Apple Podcasts. We really hope that everybody got something out of it. And again, I'm Marcia Slocum alongside Nalima Grover, and this has been Impact Point, and we will see you the next time.